This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The hate is back. Extreme climate denial. Where does it come from?
Well, when you peel back the mask of environmentalism, you always come face to face with eugenics and mass death every single time.
I just read you other gurus saying we need authoritarianism, eco-fascism is loving, eco-fascism is good. They are coming with weapons. They are militarizing all the major environmental groups. They're going to rule you. They are parasites. They are bloated scum, filth, trash. We're going under criminal takeover, criminal murderers. We'll be back.
Is doubt about climate science manufactured?
Dr. Naomi Oreskes has a unique marriage of expertise in both global warming and the history of science. She is a professor at the University of California, San Diego. Her early books were on geophysics, plate tectonics, and continental drift theory. But now, Naomi enters a more public battle with her newest book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Dr. Oreskes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me on the show.
During my own research in the early 1990s, I kept bumping up against a group of scientists promoting dubious products like tobacco and even asbestos.
Mm-hmm.
And they were joined by other authority figures like Dixie Lee Ray, a former governor of Washington State who never met a toxic chemical she didn't like. Many of the press releases came from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Are these some of the figures in your book, Merchants of Doubt?
Yes, absolutely. And that is exactly really what the book is all about. It's about a pattern where we see the same people and the same organizations cropping up repeatedly, as you say, to defend toxic chemicals, to defend pollution, to claim that pollution isn't harmful, and then in the final chapter of our book, the final issue, to say that there is no global warming.
I suppose the surprise isn't so much that big polluters hire spokespeople, even scientists. My question is, how did such a small number of people get so much media attention? They looked like an equal half in a public debate when they weren't. How did they do it?
Exactly. Well, that's exactly the question that we pose, because as you say, it's not exactly surprising that the tobacco industry would try to downplay the harms of tobacco, or the chemical industry would try to downplay the harms of toxic chemicals. But there were two things that we thought were surprising. One was, why would reputable scientists participate in such an activity? And the other, as you say, how did they manage to have so much impact? So the answer to the first question we discuss in the book at great length is really ideological. And in the book, we show that the scientists who became involved in these activities were not selling out for money, at least not directly, not in the sense of their own personal gain. They were really motivated by an ideological commitment to free markets and a fear, it's really fear-driven, a fear that if the government took steps to control whether it was acid rain or global warming or DDT, that that would lead to encroaching government control of all aspects of our life. So that ideological drive helps to understand why otherwise reputable scientists would do and say a lot of really, in our view, disreputable things. Now, on the question of how they had so much impact, so there's two parts to that. The first has to do with their reputations. The tobacco industry learned early on that if they said that tobacco was good for you, most of us wouldn't be so stupid as to think that that was credible. But if they could hire distinguished scientists to say, well, you know, science is a very complicated business, and there's a lot of things about cancer that we don't understand, and it's not really clear that tobacco is as hazardous as some extremists are claiming. If they could get a president of the National Academy of Sciences to say that, then that would have credibility, and the press would take that seriously. So this was really a crucial part of the strategy that we document very clearly in the book, the recruitment of distinguished, prestigious scientists. And it's been ironic for us because, you know, we've been attacked recently by one of the children of one of the people we write about in the book, a son, and his defense of his own father was to say, my father was a very distinguished scientist. And we say, yes, that's exactly the point.
And who were some of those prestigious scientists?
Well, in the book, we track a group of three crucial scientists and a fourth one who joined them a little later, who created a think tank called the George C. Marshall Institute in Washington, D.C. And the Marshall Institute was really dedicated to this concept of fighting government regulation as the slippery slope to socialism. And the three we track in particular were all physicists, And they were all Cold Warriors who had worked in Cold War rocketry and weapons programs. And it was that Cold War connection that was related to their political views, which were deeply, deeply anti-communist, really took very, very seriously the idea of Soviet domination, communist domination. But when the Cold War ended, really couldn't let go. It's like they kept fighting the Cold War even after the Cold War was over. And they saw the threat of communism everywhere, you know, even in things like climate science.
I suppose it's inevitable the profitable polluters will also try to influence politics and social policy. We see the most recent exposés of the multi-billionaire Koch brothers, for example, and they donated to earlier anti-environmental think tanks along with Exxon and chemical companies. But I have to say the same billionaires and mega corporations also pay for a lot of university buildings and professional chairs at universities and scientific research. So is it going to be possible to maintain an airtight wall between corporate ideology and science?
Well, no, of course, I don't think it will ever be possible to have an airtight wall. But I think that, you know, air is the key, right? Fresh air and sunshine and bringing things to light is really the key to understanding what's going on. So, as you say, a corporation has the right to present its views in public, and I don't think anybody would deny that. But what's kind of worrisome about this story that we tell is the way in which they hide their influence, the way they hide their tracks. So you mentioned earlier on the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and they are indeed one of the groups that appears in our story, along with the Marshall Institute, the Cato Institute, and a number of other of these organizations. And they receive funding from various different corporate sources and also conservative and libertarian foundations. But because they appear to be independent, they seem to have a credibility that we might not otherwise grant them if we knew that, you know, if the money were coming directly or the comments, but, you know, the arguments were coming directly from industry. And also, again, you mentioned the press earlier. This is where the press are really key, because these things seem to be coming from think tanks that seem to be independent and seem to be credible. The press quote them very extensively, and we've seen in the climate change debate, in many cases, prestigious newspapers like the Washington Post or the New York Times will quote spokespeople from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. But those spokespeople are, in fact, presenting the views of industry. And we've seen this very extensively recently with the Cato Institute. There's a man named Patrick Michaels who's been a very vocal voice doubting the scientific evidence of global warming or doubting the severity of it. Or most recently, last year when there was the incident of the stolen emails from the United Kingdom, he was very, very vocal in saying, look, this proves what I've been saying all along. You know, there's something wrong in the state of climate science. And he was very extensively quoted, even in the New York Times. But the fact is the Cato Institute gets most of its support from corporations that have a very strong vested interest in not seeing legislation on climate change. And one of those groups is the very ones you just mentioned, the Koch Industries, who are the largest controllers of oil and gas pipelines in the United States.
It seems like a very complex machine with a lot of curtains that keeps the public from making the dots, connecting the dots. Can we call it a conspiracy?
Of course. Well, we get asked that question all the time. And of course, you can call it anything you want. I have to be more careful, right? I don't like to use the word conspiracy because, you know, for a lot of people that conjures up illegality. And one of the things that's really important about this story is to understand how these folks, as far as we know, did not do anything illegal. They were very, very careful to make sure that everything they said, everything they did was within the bounds of the law, and also in many cases, not always, but in most cases, not to actually lie. And this is in a way the beauty, but also the hideousness of the strategy, right? And again, this was developed by the tobacco industry. What they realized was that you didn't have to lie, that science, real science, is complicated. And often people don't actually understand complicated science, and it's not their fault. You know, these things are complex issues. Experts spend decades trying to work these things out, so it's not surprising that many of us would have trouble understanding the details of the science. And this is really crucial, there is always uncertainty in all science. Science never proves anything absolutely positively. So it was this reality, this truth, that the tobacco industry and then all of those who followed exploited. They took the real uncertainty, the natural uncertainty in all science, they took the real complexity of science, and they tried to use that to make us think that we really didn't know the answer to these questions. You used the phrase at the very beginning of the show, is doubt about climate science manufactured? And we always say, no, it's not manufactured. There's always reasonable doubt in any live debate. Anytime people are studying, anytime people are asking questions, it's in the very nature of science, in the very nature of inquiry, that of course there's doubt. Doubt is what drives science. But these people take that and they use it against science. So it's almost like a jujitsu move where they take what's a strength of science, the way doubt drives curiosity, and they turn it against it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist and author Naomi Oreskes. Naomi, I'd have to say the strategy of creating doubt in our public minds about established science, it has worked. America still has no legislation to limit greenhouse gases. Canada doesn't. How costly in terms of damage to our future climate do you think this delay is? I mean, will our grandchildren call it criminal, as James Hansen has suggested?
Well, we think it's pretty costly. In the book, we try as much as possible to let the reader come to their own conclusions about that. But I think any reader who, you know, picks up the book will see that there's a pattern. And the pattern is that in every one of the cases we document, from the original debates about tobacco to the current debates about global warming, that there's been very substantial delay between the time that the science was established and the time that something was actually done about it. And that period of delay led to a lot of profits for a lot of people, but it also led to a lot of damage to the environment. It led to, in the case of tobacco, a lot of what we would argue would probably be unnecessary deaths from cancer and other tobacco-related diseases. So there's a real cost. And as you said, you know, global warming is the unfinished business because we've known about the reality of global warming for a long time now, and yet we continue not to do anything about it. And what's really damaging, of course, in the case of global warming is that the damage is irreversible. So every day we delay, every month, every year, every decade, because we're now talking about decades of delay, the problem gets worse. It gets harder to solve. Is it criminal? Well, I let that for the lawyers to decide.
Good enough. Well, in your book, Merchants of Doubt, you show this repetitive strategy, misusing a few scientists and other authorities. My question now, after 30 years of the same old song and dance, why do we keep falling for it? Doesn't that suggest that the consumer, too, has been willing to hear reasons why we should just keep on polluting? Aren't we, as we belch out our carbon and buy things from the Walmart and stripping resources from the planet, aren't we part of this conspiracy? Is that why we accept it?
Of course we are all part of it. And elsewhere, Eric Conway and I have written things about what individuals can do, and we've certainly spoken on this issue. And certainly we do agree with psychologists who say, look, if somebody is given a choice between two accounts, one of which says, wow, things are really bad, you need to change the way you do business, and the other which says, oh, everything's fine, don't worry. You know, most of us would prefer to hear the everything's fine, don't worry. So, of course, individuals play a role in this. Individuals accept these messages of doubt, but we still think that, you know, responsibility should be laid squarely where it most belongs. And I think, you know, when we were writing this book, we knew something about some of these earlier debates about the ozone hole and acid rain, a little bit about tobacco, but it wasn't until we wrote this book that we realized how extensive this pattern was, how repetitive, and how much we really had been, in a way, conned. So I think that, you know, an ordinary person who's busy with their own life maybe hasn't seen the pattern, maybe hasn't had someone connect the dots for them. And so what we've really tried to do in the book is to show that pattern, to connect the dots, so a person can pick up the book and read it and say, oh my gosh, I really didn't know this. And we have had lots of people, even scientists who are involved in doing the scientific work on many of the issues, have said to us, oh my gosh, I really didn't know this.
Have you had any blowback from the Merchants of Doubt? Do you get heat for exposing what they do?
Well, of course. And as I said, there is a son of one of the Merchants of Doubt who's been very vocal on the Internet, accusing us of being irresponsible historians and making false allegations, actually, about our historical work. And it's a difficult challenge to know whether one should respond to these accusations or not. We think our work stands for itself. Anyone who picks up the book will see there's a lot of footnotes in the back. We spent 5 years doing the research, so we feel pretty confident that the work stands.
Despite some belated apologies from the media, scientists are still under attack, not just in dictatorial countries, but right in the United States. The Attorney General of Virginia, as you know, Ken Cuccinelli, tried to investigate Dr. Michael Mann, formerly from the University of Virginia, and the famous hockey stick author, modeling rising global temperatures. And this Attorney General did not believe in human-induced climate change, and he wanted to charge Dr. Mann with fraud. That was tossed out. But the specter of right-wing governments investigating climate scientists won't go away. We've got elections coming up, plenty of climate deniers running for office. Is it safe to be outspoken about climate research in this political climate?
Well, it's not safe. And as you point out, many people who have spoken out, even people who haven't spoken out publicly, just scientists who have been doing their work as scientists, have been attacked. And they have been attacked, as you pointed out, by the U.S. government. And that is a very frightening state of affairs. Yeah, it's very worrisome, and I think it speaks to what's at stake here. And it's not surprising that people are fighting back tooth and nail, because there is a lot at stake. Energy use is at the root of all economic activity, and I think we have to be prepared. I think in some ways, scientists, environmentalists, at least if we go back to the 1990s, I think a lot of scientists involved in the climate issue, I have to say, were naive. I think they thought that if they did really good scientific work, and if they demonstrated the evidence, and if they explained it clearly, then people would understand what was at stake, they would understand the threat, and we would get action. And at first, it looked like that was true. So if you think about the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, in 1992, it was signed by President George H.W. Bush and 163 other signatories from around the world. It did look as if the world was ready to take action on the basis of the clear scientific evidence. But then, and in the book we show how the resistance then builds up as the scientific evidence gets stronger and stronger, the resistance also gets stronger and stronger too, to the point that we now see the literal harassment of honest scientists stealing their emails. I know I have colleagues who have received death threats. I've received threatening phone calls. You know, it's an ugly world out there. People are worried about what this means. So I do think that we have to be realistic. We have to realize that, you know, there are some very unpleasant people out there who will do anything to protect their own self-interest. And so it is really important, I think, for everyone to support climate scientists, to understand that they're the victims of attack. So when their emails get stolen, to realize that this is pernicious, this is deliberate, it's a deliberate attempt to discredit them. And really for the press, as you mentioned yourself, it's really crucial that the press understand this and the press stop quoting these people who are not independent, they're not scientists. Don't quote them as if they're scientists. If you want to say the oil and gas pipeline industry feels XYZ, fine. That's a perfectly legitimate thing. It's legitimate for us to know what the position of the oil and gas pipeline industry is. But it's not legitimate to take that position, to dress it up as if it were science, and then to present it as a scientific debate.
I'm sorry to tell you, and I know you're coming on a tour or at least some speaking in Canada, but things are no better in Canada. Dr. Andrew Weaver of the University of Victoria, just in today's paper, and he's an IPCC team leader, says new government regulations are muzzling scientists. All requests for interviews from the national and international press must first be cleared with scientists' responses approved in advance by the mandarins and the political departments right up to the ministers signing off. And of course, that takes so long, the press have gone away by the time the story has died. Politicians can rewrite what scientists say or deny them access altogether. There's no free speech for taxpayer-funded scientists in Canada. Dr. Weaver calls it Orwellian. Have you heard about that?
I did. I saw that piece, and I actually saw it last night. And it is very, very worrisome, and I especially think for Canadians who often pride themselves as being maybe a little bit of a step ahead of the United States on some of these issues, I think it's a huge source of concern. And again, I think it shows the extreme steps that people are now taking to suppress the scientific evidence, because the scientific evidence is so strong and it is so compelling, and because if people understand it, they will see what's at stake. So I applaud Andrew Weaver for speaking out about what's going on. My view is that scientists should speak out. I think that scientists are often in a stronger position than they think. I really don't think the Canadian government wants to put scientists in jail. And, you know, James Hansen documented a very similar pattern that happened to him here in the United States. It's in his recent book on his experience. Every scientist should read James Hansen's book, as well as ours, of course. And I really think scientists have to not bow to this pressure. Scientists have to stand up and say they owe it to the people. As you said, this is funded by the taxpayers. Scientists owe it to the people to tell them the truth about what's going on. And if a government bureaucrat or a politician tries to stand in their way, it's really important for scientists to resist that political pressure.
And we've never needed impartial science more than now, especially climate science. How can the public support real science and the scientists? What can we do?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, you mentioned universities, obviously having public lectures, inviting scientists to speak on these issues, but community groups as well. I've been speaking to a lot of civic groups and religious organizations. Invite your local scientists to come and talk about these things. Invite them to come and talk in your school. Send them an email, giving them moral support. You know, most of us who work on this issue, our inboxes are filled with hostile and negative things from people who feel threatened. We don't get as many nice, positive emails from people who appreciate what we do. Although I have to take that back and say that for me, since the book has come out, I've gotten an incredibly gratifying email from all over the world, and I want to thank everyone who's written to me and Eric, because it's really meaningful to us to know that people appreciate what we've done and they appreciate the hard work that went into this. So be supportive. Talk to your scientists. Invite them to speak in public. And then, as you said, there are things that you can do. You can vote. You can vote out politicians who are harassing scientists and refusing to act on these issues. You can organize in your own community. You can take steps to buy green products. There's a wonderful organization called Climate Counts based in New Hampshire who are rating corporations for their activities with respect to global warming. You can get information and be an informed consumer. You know, there's a great line in the movie Food, Inc., when they say, what can you do about issues in the food industry? And they say, you know, when it comes to food, you vote three times a day, right? Every time you have a meal, you're making choices. Well, when it comes to energy, it's even more than that. You're voting 100 times a day. Every time you buy a product, every time you turn on your light, every time you get in your automobile, you're making a choice about energy issues and the environment. So I think we have a lot more power than we sometimes think, and I really think it's great, you know, that organizations like Climate Count are pointing out the ways in which consumers have power.
Is there a website for your new book that you'd like to point out?
There is. Thank you very much for asking. It's www.merchantsofdoubt.org.
Great. This is Radio EcoShock. We have been honored to have Naomi Oreskes as our guest. She has advised the EPA and the National Academy of Sciences. Her awards are many. Naomi, you have become something of a legend in the climate community. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. And I am speaking at the University of Toronto and at York University at the end of the month. So if people are interested, they can go to the websites of those universities. They can find the information about my lectures in Toronto.
We'll do that. I'm Alex Smith.
Thank you so much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green, Radio EcoShock. Join us.
not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive.
Crown Counsel bringing forth a suggestion that the court look at locking me away forever on accumulated sentences that I have had.
This is Alex Smith. We all know governments and big corporations make big mistakes. They blow up oil wells, reactors, banking systems, and whole cities, and nobody goes to jail. Nobody. But if you protest the destruction of Earth's environment, watch out. The full force of the law comes down. I've heard of harassment and dirty deals against the Greens, but I've never heard anything so disgusting as I heard today. A grandmother in her late 70s is being threatened with a life sentence. She was not charged with a criminal offense. Her protest was nonviolent. She stood on public land with a First Nations companion in front of a construction bulldozer. Now, without any jury trial and without a lawyer, Betty Croswick will make her appeal in Vancouver, Canada. The government prosecutor is calling for a life sentence, comparing Betty's protests to cases of repeated rapes of children. In Canada, a rapist might get 5 years or less. Murder has been punished with 7 years or less. But environmental protests, throw away the key! Here is Betty speaking to a supportive crowd outside the courthouse.
Of the people's liberty by this Campbell government, that it's an accumulation that is becoming, dare I say it, gross, and that we have to be alerted that we can't just continue allowing piece by piece by piece of our liberties and our right to life and our right to protest to be chipped away. So I'm here to appeal my sentence. And that's what will be happening this morning, and this will be in the face of the Crown Counsel bringing forth a suggestion that the court look at locking me away forever on accumulated sentences that I have had. But I also want to take this opportunity just briefly to remember Harriet Nahaney, who stood with me at Eagle Ridge Bluffs and who died a few days after she was released from prison. I want to remember a lot of things. I want to remember all of the protests that we have done in the past to try to preserve the environment, to try to preserve the right to protest. And this is what is happening here today, is that the Crown Counsel, through the Attorney General's office, is saying that we no longer have a right to protest. If you protest and if you keep protesting, we will lock you away forever. And we will use a process called the summary process that it will ensure that you won't have a jury trial. I could be locked away forever. And according to what the Attorney General is suggesting this morning through their case law, without ever having a jury trial, without ever having access to the criminal code in order to defend myself, they don't have to prove anything when they bring you to court on a summary code. All they have to say is you were there, you're guilty, you're going to jail. This is unfair, and I've come to the conclusion it is illegal. They simply cannot do this to the citizens of British Columbia.
Here's a clip from the famous civil rights lawyer Cameron Ward, who was not allowed to defend Betty for this appeal.
Protesting against the environmental degradation caused by clear-cut logging and industrial practices, or whether it's the cause of promoting the rights of Aboriginal women and advocating for better lives for them. She has, as I say, really been in the forefront and has put everything on the line to get her message out. I just want to say a few words about the process that finds us and Betty here today. Betty, of course, as you know, was convicted and sentenced to a term of 10 years in jail. She was given no credit for time served awaiting her trial. She was given no period of remission, as most offenders are. She had to serve the entire 10 months in jail. And it's important to realize that she was not prosecuted under the Criminal Code of Canada. She was not charged with breaking any law. Rather, the process that led to her arrest and conviction arose from the fairly benign act. She and Harriet Nahani sat or stood on a piece of public land in symbolic opposition to the construction crews that were about to lay waste to it. And that benign act, which wasn't prosecuted as a breach of the law, happened to be disobeying what a judge had earlier told her and others not to do. And because she didn't do as she was told, the courts came down on her and came down on her very hard indeed. She ended up serving more time in jail than people who actually hurt others in the commission of serious crimes often spend in jail. And this process, I've got to be careful about what I say about it, but this process is in fact, in my view, an abuse of the court system. It is and has been described by a judge of the BC Supreme Court. A courageous judge of the BC Supreme Court, the Honorable Mr. Justice Mark McEwen, described the process that Betty faced here as a kind of officially induced abuse of process. And that's indeed what it is. And Betty will have a chance today to say as much as she can about that process when she appears before three justices of the Court of Appeal. And for my part, although I can't be there beside her, I'll be with her in spirit and emotionally, and I wish her nothing but the greatest success in continuing to get her message out. So thank you again.
And finally, let us hear from the elders, the Raging Grannies, singing on the courthouse steps.
We have a new one that was just written for Betty today.
This is a world premiere.
For all of us.
Yeah, for all of us.
Which civil liberties would you fight for? Put your freedoms on the line more than ever before. She struggled to keep Eagle Ridge wild and free. She's Betty, the queen of BCology. Betty's been a fighter in her struggle to save the forest primeval from clear-cutting knaves, proving she's a leader when leaders are rare, and Betty does it all and with flair to spare. Betty was a nuisance, that was her crime. Judges can't stand the nuisance of the environmental kind. She has pluck and perseverance, her principles in charge. For Betty, all together now, we thank our lucky stars.
Written for Betty Kay, fast becoming the green Nelson Mandela of the North as crazed prosecutors try to lock her away forever.
A scientist tells people the truth.
The warming of the planet is causing extremes of weather. Our civilization is based on a norm, not extremes. Extremes are never good, and extremes are really never good when it comes to feeding the planet.
And now for something a bit different, this is a Skype video interview I did with Dr. Peter Ward at the University of Washington about his new book, The Flooded Earth. You can find it at YouTube. My YouTube name is Path Unknown, or just look for Radio EcoShock, Peter Ward, and you'll find the three videos of this interview. For now, let's listen to it on radio. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm here with a person I consider to be an old friend, Dr. Peter Ward. He's a climatologist at the University of Washington. He's also a biologist.
And he teaches, he explores, he goes around the world exploring. One of his specialties is why things go extinct, and maybe that's something humans have to pay attention. Peter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me again.
You're the author of many books. Under a Green Sky really turned my life around, frightened me a little bit, and I now understand you have a new book that I'd like to talk to you about in a few minutes, but tell us what's the title and what's it about.
My new book is dealing with what I think is the most significant and scary aspect of climate change, which is the fact that as we warm, which we are doing, ice melts, obviously, and the ice that's melting is in the Arctic and Antarctic regions, and it is that ice melting that causes sea level to rise, and it's rising sea level that poses the most important threat, I think, to human civilization, not so much from the water coming in my office now and getting my feet all wet, but the sea level rise really affects us from what hurts us most, which is, to me at least, my stomach, feeding. Sea level rise is going to affect agriculture. Agriculture in a planet where we're at 6.6 billion, going up to 9 billion, we cannot afford to lose low-lying agricultural grounds, and that's what sea level rise can do.
Okay, well, I want to really dig into that in the second part of our interview. For right now, though, we've just had one heck of a summer. We had the Russian heat wave, and, well, in fact, the hottest July ever, according to NASA, and we had the Pakistan floods, as you know, and the Arctic ice is really low. Can you talk to us about some of those events and your take on them?
Well, any one particular year or any one particular summer can never be used as a justification for a trend, obviously. But nevertheless, if we look at the last 10 years, we have some of the hottest, I forget how many of the year, hottest years on record, we're starting to really look like a trend. I think that the Russian heat wave, as well as the Pakistan, the way the monsoon worked, are two of the scariest nudges, really, that should get our politicians pushed to really understand this is not going to go away. Now, we may be followed by two or three very cold winters or very, very cold summers, even in Russia or somewhere else, and people will be tempted to say, aha, see, it's over. But it's not. Last winter in the U.S., we had one of the snowiest winters ever, and people say, look, there's no global warming because it snowed and snowed and snowed. Why did it snow so much? Because there was way more water in the air that hit the cold, cold Canadian air coming down. And you've got more water in the air because elsewhere it has been warmer than before. We've got more water vapor because of the heating. That hits a cold front, of course, it's going to snow out, but it's all part of the same problem. The warming of the planet is causing extremes of weather. Our civilization is based on a norm, not extremes. Extremes are never good, and extremes are really never good when it comes to feeding the planet.
I think you bring out a really good point that it could be cold next winter, and that doesn't say anything. It's the long-term trend that's going. We had Senator Inhofe out there building a snow house for Al Gore just because it snowed in D.C. last winter. Come on. But the point is, these extreme events, it's been predicted they'll happen more often, and that seems to be what we're seeing. So when does the point come where we say, yes, this is climate change?
Well, that's a great question. I believe that generation by generation, as this keeps ramping up warmer and warmer and warmer, that conversation will be over. But in the meantime, we need action now. I've been completely disappointed by the Obama administration and what it has not done for climate change. Yes, it pushed through health care, but climate change should have been number one, because climate change will ultimately be, I think, a major factor in health care. When we start seeing on the global sense people without enough food, even if the U.S. and Canada can feed themselves, it's going to have an effect. The effect that happens is as our surpluses go away because of these extremes of weather. I mean, already because of the Russian heat wave, as we know, the wheat futures have been skyrocketing, and food riots began in northern Africa already. We saw this about 3 years ago with the downturn in the amount of corn going out because of the biofuel initiative. So we start putting more, just a bit more corn in a biofuel, and all of a sudden we've got food riots. We are really on a knife edge, and extremes of weather are the ones that will affect us most importantly, which is why I think we have to at least start the conversation in a serious tone in the U.S. We've got to do something about cap and trade. We really have to do something about global climate.
And yet that's off the menu for the Senate and for the House. They're just not going to do anything, apparently.
No, it's not going to happen, especially until this election is over. And if the Republicans again take over even the House of Representatives, what we can look forward to, at least in the United States, will be the next 2 years of investigations. No legislation, only investigation. And they've already said they're going to do that. You know, we'll take all these guys, put them in prison. This is not what the world needs right now. I just have this horrible sense, sinking sense, that 20, 50 years from now, there'll be this rogues gallery of the guilty sort of lined up on some wall. These were the people that let down the human race.
Well, the Arctic sea ice is again near a record low, but you say that doesn't really impact the rising seas idea. Can you straighten that out for us?
Sure. It's just some of the best pictures you can get. And again, because the northern hemisphere is a lot more approachable than the southern, Arctic sea ice disappears. People think, oh my gosh, this is really a big problem that's going to cause the seas to rise. My ice is melting. My gosh, the oceans are going up. But that ice is already floating on the ocean or sitting on the ocean. That's not the ice that affects us. It's ice on land that affects us. You cannot say that the loss of Arctic sea ice is unimportant. In fact, there is a huge secondary importance to that. We can come back to that in a second. It's Antarctica and Greenland that really, I think, are going to dictate the fate for human civilization over the long term if we can keep the ice sheets in place. Sea level will stay relatively constant. It is ice that's sitting up on land that melts, that every drop of that water causes a rise of sea level. Every single drop on some minuscule fraction, there's going to be some slight rise in sea level. The floating ice, nothing. The ice that sits on Antarctica and Greenland are the two really most important sources of sea level change. How can you not have global temperatures rising and not see an increase in the melting of those two bodies? And in fact, we are seeing those. Now, why the Arctic ice is so important, it's white. It reflects sunshine back into space. A white planet is cooler than a planet this dark. It's called albedo. As we melt away the Arctic sea ice, we get dark ocean replacing white sea ice. That ocean warms. It warms the whole planet to some minuscule, again, but some real fraction. The more Arctic sea ice melts, the warmer the planet gets, and there's a feedback here.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we're here with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. We're talking about his new book, The Flooded Earth, and just the general events of climate around the world. Peter, the new book seems a bit of a change for you. I know that you've been an expert diver, you've looked under the sea, you've poked around on land, working away at different ridges to see what the deep past can tell us. But now you're dealing with the cryosphere, the ice world. Why did you make that change?
Well, a couple of reasons. My deep past work has always been really looking at deep time. But over the last 3 years, that deep time has sent me down to Antarctica. And unless you're really, truly blind, you can't sit in Antarctica and watch it melting away as all that water makes its way from the land frozen to the ocean wet and not really understand that there's major changes taking place. I was able to see down in one of the Antarctic bases photographs of 50 years ago where the glaciers were around this particular base on the Antarctic Peninsula, and every one of them has receded, as we know, is taking place elsewhere in the planet. But secondly, there's something that deep time gives you the perspective of. Our problem, and we began this interview saying 1 year does not make a trend, but with deep time, you have all the years you ever want. We can go back 500 million years and look at the rock record for the last 500 million years. We have really good indicators of what the climate was like in deep time. Was it warm? Was it cold? Okay. In the warm climate times, how much ice was there on the planet? Well, zero to none. And what was the carbon dioxide levels during warm times versus cold times? So deep times lets us understand there's not a relationship between the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the temperature of the planet. We can get rid of that one because we have lots of people say, oh no, it's solar cycles and this and that. No, we really can see this one-to-one correspondence. Carbon dioxide goes up, global temperatures go up. We can go back 55 million years ago. Carbon dioxide was about 1,000 parts per million. Now it's 300 and almost 390. But back then, 1,000 parts per million, Canada was a lush tropical jungle all the way up to the Arctic Circle because we have crocodiles and alligators in the far northern reaches of Canada 55 billion years ago. High CO2. Well, let's go back, way back. Let's go back to the Permian. Carbon dioxide dropped way below levels to what it was now. We had a 40 to 50 million year long glaciation. Down went CO2, up went the ice. And it just drives me crazy when we have senators in Oklahoma who discount this so simple relationship that deep time tells us. So certainly there's that deep time sense of things that got me into thinking about sea level change. We see it all the time in the rock record. You can watch on a sedimentary outcrop. You walk, as you go higher or lower, you can see that the sea level has gone up or gone down. Why not bring that to the modern day? So that was the impetus of this particular book.
And the sea level is so fundamental to our way of thinking. We think of it as a fairly fixed thing. All our docks are at a certain level. Our maps show so many feet above sea level. We're going to have to rewrite the geography of the world if this happens.
Well, a little bit by little bit we will, but the greater worry right now is going to be rewriting the economic history of the world. We have just seen in the U.S. over these past 3 or 4 years this enormous depression, really. They call it a recession that was based on bankers being greedy. And one segment of the economy, housing, drove us into what is essentially a global slowdown. Well, what happens when we have to spend enormous quantities of money to change infrastructure? Not just one country, but every country. And let's look at something as simple as the height of a wharf for a pier. Sea level goes up, and global commerce deals mainly from country to country. Railroads, and many of these are right at sea level. Highways, many right at sea level, and shipping. And the ports themselves are predicated on sea level is not going to change. Well, some places where I live, there's what we call mesotidal. There's pretty high sea level changes just every day from the tides, 3 meters perhaps. But some places have no sea level change through tides every day. Well, look, global sea level is going to mean that every place is going to rise. If you have built a pier for a specific sea level, and that sea level changes by a meter or 2 meters, in many cases, that pier is not going to work anymore. You're going to have to rebuild that thing. Last year, CNN suggested, or at least thought, that by going through a series of economic models, they came up with several $1 trillion just to change pier height if it goes up as little as a half a meter around the world. Trillions of dollars. We've got so much infrastructure based on this sense that sea level will never change.
And I'm trying to imagine the possibility of drowned cities, and I think of the city of Alexandria, which now you can see museum tours of what they've brought up of the temples and the statues from under the Mediterranean Sea. Now, I know that was caused by subsidence, the sinking of the coastline, and it was caused by tsunamis from the earthquakes that happened over the 2,300 years since Alexander the Great founded that city. But 2,300 years from now, are you predicting we'll be, or someone may be, finding the remains of New York City or other great cities of the world?
Well, it really depends on if there is a critical tipping point or not. And once again, the temperatures of planets, we're doing a vast experiment, and we do not know what the answer is. I mean, it may very well be that that ice is pretty impervious, that it will take thousands of years for the ice to melt sufficiently to cause the flooding of cities. I mean, if it does melt, it's going to go up 80 meters, and then you could say, kiss goodbye all the coastal cities. But maybe it's 80 meters over thousands of years. But if we go back to the time of the highest sea level rise, the last glaciation, there was a lot more ice. And that ice melted from these vast ice ages that we've just come out of. We saw 5 meters per century, 15 feet in 100 years. That was enough to completely flood out a lot of coastal cities. And one of the most poignant, I think, was in the Black Sea. Divers have found a whole series of villages, and off Israel as well now, another series of villages that seem to have been flooded out by this really rapid rise, probably about 7,000 to 8,000 years ago, the most rapid of the rise of sea levels, 15 feet in a century, is just, imagine Vancouver or Halifax or any of these cities that in 100 years, you've got 5 meters sea level change. Now you're talking about wholesale calamity from an infrastructure point of view.
And that's happening at a time when many of us believe that we've reached peak oil, that our fossil fuel resources are going to be used up, and we're barely coping, as you say, right now, economically. It feels like a depression to me also. So where are we going to come up with the resources to make these grand plans for adaptation, I wonder?
Well, I don't think there will be, in the sense that I think cities will just keep migrating upward and inward. The sad part will be the great fight over the great art treasures. Remember when we had these dams along the Nile And there were enormous Egyptian art treasures that were going to be flooded. And the same in China. There was a whole series of archaeological areas that were to be flooded. Pretty soon, you just have to give up on some of this most beautiful of all of human architecture. You're just going to say, look, you know, it becomes triage. The city can be saved. The city can't. Dealing with economics, we can already look at the Dutch. The Dutch right now are spending vast sums of money on not just dikes. I mean, dikes is the simplistic way to look at it. It's far more complicated than that now. You put out sand dunes of great size. You have a whole series of river barriers because it's not just the ocean going up. It's also the interaction of oceans and rivers where they meet them. This is a huge, important area for flooding as well. But when we start spending so much money on infrastructure to save a city, there's going to become a point where sooner or later you say, all right, you know, no more good money after bad. We just can't afford it. We can't afford it. Goodbye city. And I think Miami in North America is Galveston. That one's going to certainly be gone. Even with minor sea level change, those areas just cannot support any rise of sea level at all.
And in your book, The Flooded Earth, Peter Ward, you talk about the San Francisco and the Sacramento Valley areas. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we know that at least in the United States, the greatest single agricultural region for productivity is the Great Valleys of California. The San Joaquin Valley to the south of Sacramento and the Sacramento Valley to the north, these are enormous, extremely rich, richly productive agricultural regions. I don't know the percentage, but a gigantic amount of North America's vegetables come out of this San Joaquin Valley and then further south into some of the troughs, the Imperial Valley, fruit, vegetables. We also have grasslands, enormous amount of livestock. These areas are vastly threatened not by the rise of the sea, but by the rise of salinity in the soil. Rising sea level is one problem, but when you have an ocean going up, it also goes laterally. As we know, if you have dry soil and just put some water on it, it diffuses through. Well, it actually diffuses through sideways very, very easily. And anytime you have salt water hitting agricultural soil, that diffusion sideways is our greatest problem. This is the greatest threat affecting Bangladesh, in fact. It's not so much that sea level rise is going to cover up a lot of their property, which it will. It is that the areas that the sea doesn't yet touch will still be ruined for agriculture. Bangladesh is a place where agriculture feeds its populace right now, but barely. But as their numbers rise, which they will in the next 50 years, and as sea level rises in the next 50 years, more and more salt is going into areas they cannot afford to lose. So this is, as I say, the single greatest threat. It is human starvation based on salinization of low-lying crop areas.
What is the range of sea level rise expected in this century by various scientific authorities?
Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is the multi-scientist organization that's every country has put people in. They've suggested in their last assessment that we might see, at most 59 centimeters, but they're thinking probably about 30 to 40 to 50 centimeters, somewhere in there, a half meter as the maximum problem by 2100. Now, this was put together in 2007 by a committee. And we all have seen committees at work, but not just that, it's put together by a committee of scientists, none of whom wanted to be labeled as an extremist. And so they went conservative. No one who really has been modeling and studying sea level rise, even at that time, people were screaming, that's just ludicrous to be so low. And we hope it stays so low, 44 centimeters or 39 centimeters. That sounds great. But now the sense is that if we have only 1 meter by 2100, that's great. But unfortunately, even 1 meter is increasingly looking like something that's very conservative. There's a man named Stefan Rahmstorf in Germany who does some of the best modeling. Now, once again, we don't have time machines. We can't tell you what it's going to be. So the only way you can do it is use mathematical models. But the model that Stefan has suggested is that if we have about a meter and a half by 2100, that's probably about right. Not 2 meters, not 1 meter, someplace in between, maybe 1.25 meters. So you're looking at 4 or 5 feet. According to most of the specialists, by 2100. So this is really difficult, very difficult for the agricultural sectors, very, very difficult or infrastructure to have to deal, even with 4 to 5 feet, meter and a half, that's a really tough number for society to deal with.
Well, my grandchild's 5 months old, so I expect it's possible he may see those levels of new seas, and it's going to be a startling time for him to go through. You know, Dr. James Lovelock and other scientists have suggested that without ice caps, the wind and the ocean currents could stall and become very pacified, and that could have big changes for the world's climate. Can you talk about that?
Sure. We've known from deep time again that when we have times of no ice, that's simply because it's very, very hot. The way the world works, when global warming happens, it does not happen at the same temperature range all over the planet. The ice areas, the areas that now have ice, in fact, heat up a whole lot more. We're seeing that now. We're seeing that the Arctic and the Antarctic are warming much faster than the equator. The equator is already so hot, it can't get a whole lot hotter. But the poles can certainly get a lot hotter. And what causes ocean circulation and wind in the first place? It is simply temperature differences. Whenever we get wind, it's because there's someplace hotter and someplace warmer around us, and the air is trying to move from one place to the other. Well, it's the same for ocean currents. The problem being is that once ocean currents slow or stop, oxygen availability to the deep ocean slows and stops. You start losing oxygen. So that's where you can really have some major problems.
And you alluded to something earlier, which I've heard from Dr. James Hansen, which is that once this process begins, there could be a tipping point beyond which, you know, reducing our carbon emissions and such may not have any effect, that it seems in the Earth's past, once the slide of ice goes off Greenland and Antarctica, it just keeps going under its own power. Did I get that right?
Oh, that's totally correct. Again, this is the scariest aspect, is that there is this sense of a tipping point. No one quite knows what the level of carbon dioxide that it would be, but we do know, again, that if we go into deep time, there's been little or no ice at all at 1,000 parts per million. Now, getting to 1,000 parts per million means burning up a whole lot of oil and coal, and it's almost a case where you think, gee, maybe we'll run out of both before we hit 1,000 or before we have 1,000 long enough to melt everything. Maybe we'll hit 1,000 and it'll dip back down. The fact is, there's a great amount of coal on this planet. The greatest misnomer to me of all is this mantra, clean coal, clean coal. Well, there's no such thing. Burning coal as the cheapest form of energy, and once oil is gone, as you well know, it will be the cheapest form of energy. Or the oil shales going on in Canada and Alberta right now with those oil shales that will be or might be or soon could be one of the greatest single point sources of emissions on planet Earth. Is the formation of oil from oil shales. This is a really energy-intensive, emissions-intensive production.
Well, as we start to wrap up our conversation, which I'm really enjoying, incidentally, what other scientific research are you most excited about or worried about? What's got your interest?
Well, the hope is the reason we went to Antarctica in the first place is to hopefully get a sense of, is it possible that perhaps our models are wrong? Maybe it's just possible that 1,000 parts per million will still let us have at least some ice sheets. And so we're looking at Cretaceous-age rocks, these rocks from 65 to 125 million years old, to try to see how rapidly did sea level go up and down and up and down. Maybe there was ice sheet information to be had. Maybe we could still keep some of the ice at least at 1,000 parts per million. And if so, it really tells us that maybe we're going to have a little bit more time to deal with emissions. My worry is that it's not, but this is kind of the all-consuming thing to figure out right now. How high can CO2 be and allow you to still have ice? In other words, how long can we still keep Antarctica and Greenland at 1,000 parts per million?
Can you recommend a website for people who want to find out more?
I think that really the best climate source on the planet is called realclimate.org. And this is a consortium of climate people from many different countries, but they're not rabid crazies, but they're not conservative crazies. This is really middle of the road. It's at realclimate.org, and this is where I get most of my climate information. I've been in touch. These people are really great.
Right. I think Gavin Schmidt is one of the good writers there, and I check it out on a regular basis. Our guest has been Peter Ward. He's a paleoclimatologist and biologist at the University of Washington. He's got a new book out called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps.
That's it.
Yeah. And I find Peter's books are really exciting to read. They're page turners. They're kind of like detective novels, or maybe they're horror books because they're kind of scary, but they're definitely nonfiction. They are fact-based. And you want to get some good science, you go to Peter Ward. Radio EcoShock, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.